This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. New crime statistics were just released by the FBI, which show a 3% dip in major crimes reported to the police. But some experts say these statistics mask a grim truth. The rate at which boys in their early teens are committing crimes is skyrocketing. Earlier this year, my guest Walter Dickey released his study called What Every Policymaker Should Know About Imprisonment and the Crime Rate. The number of Americans in prison has quadrupled during the past 20 years. And Dickey says Americans think that by building more prisons, they're creating a safer country. But Dickey says it doesn't work that way. His study found that imprisoning more people and lengthening their average stay is ineffective in lowering the rate of violent crime. This is in part because the criminal justice system deals with only a small fraction of crimes committed. And most violent crime is committed impulsively, often under the influence of drugs or alcohol, so that threats of punishment have little deterrent value. Walter Dickey is special counsel for policy for the Campaign for an Effective Crime Policy, a coalition of criminal justice and elected officials founded in 1992 to encourage a less politicized, more informed debate about crime. From 1983 to 87, Dickey directed the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Dickey says long sentences don't deter crime. I asked him about other alternatives.
One of the questions that needs serious examination is what is the difference between, let's say, a 4-year sentence and a 6-year sentence in terms of its effect on this offender and on crime rates? I think we really think that we're having an effect when we say 6 and not 4, as though there's some magical difference between the two. But the fact of the matter is we know very little about the different meanings and significance of terms of imprisonment. And when you sort of draw that out over time, I think it becomes even more dramatic. Here in Wisconsin, not long ago, there was a young woman who was sentenced to life in prison with a parole eligibility date of 50 years from now for a homicide. She's 28 years old at the time of her sentencing. We can certainly ask the question, what are we buying in terms of reduced crime when she's 29? But she's also going to be 39, 49, 59, and 69 before she reaches parole eligibility. And it seems to me, to the extent we are buying anything with that in terms of increased safety, it certainly is diminishing over time, because one of the things that we do know is that as people age, they become much less crime prone. So in thinking about sentence length, we really need to be much more careful about thinking through what we're buying with varying lengths of sentences. Are there alternatives that work? I think demonstrably. Obviously, there's a question about what do you mean when you say work? What's the point of comparison? One simple point of comparison is prison. Do alternatives to imprisonment work as well as prison? If you use, again, what I would say are somewhat simple kinds of notions about how you measure that thing, like recidivism rates, I think it's very clear that for many offenders, we have alternatives. Here in Wisconsin, we have one that's called intensive sanctions that do far better over time than prison does.
What's intensive sanctions?
Intensive sanctions is what we call a third sentence in Wisconsin. We developed it just a few years ago. We call it in between probation and prison. It allows for a period of confinement, though that period of confinement does not have to be at the time the person is sentenced. The confinement can include living in a halfway house, going to a drug treatment program. The sentence is thought to emphasize restitution, some degree of restoration to the victim for the crime that's been committed, community service, emphasis upon surveillance, both of a watching kind and of a helping kind in the community, but really delivered in a way that is far more intensive than normal probation. Just by way of comparing costs, normal probation is thought to cost in Wisconsin about $1,300 a year per offender. Prison is thought to cost about $25,000 or $26,000 per year. Intensive sanctions cost about $6,000 per year. It's only 4 years old. It's got about 2,200 inmates in it right now. And when I say inmates, they're people who otherwise otherwise would have been sentenced to prison. Their recidivism rate over this four-year period, admittedly a short time, is less than half the recidivism rate for similar offenders who go to prison. So yes, there are things that work, and I think that's been demonstrated not only in Wisconsin but in lots of other places.
Have you evaluated boot camps as an alternative to prison?
Yes, I have. In fact, I wrote a paper for the Campaign for Effective Crime Policy on boot camps. I would say that boot camps are a gimmick, and boot camps demonstrably, number one, usually do not save money. In fact, they're more expensive than prison. And secondly, have recidivism rates that are almost identical to the recidivism rates of people who go to prison. I think boot camps are mostly sort of showy and politically attractive because they have this element of activity and things that people associate with what they'd like prison to be. But in terms of those measures, recidivism and cost, they're almost indistinguishable from prison. I do think, too, that to the extent boot camps have been helpful, I think it's mostly been a function of what's happened after boot camp, not because of what happened during boot camp. And the national studies of this really bear that out. Those boot camp programs that have got good, what are called aftercare situations, where they're really involved with the inmate, they don't just drop them off in some inner city and say, see you later, have got a far better record than those boot camp programs that basically release the person to nothing different in their lives. And what I think that suggests is it's not the boot camp that makes the difference, it's what you provide the person as they're being reintegrated into the community that makes a difference.
Walter Dickey is my guest, and he works with the Campaign for an Effective Crime Policy, which is a coalition of criminal justice and elected officials founded to encourage a less politicized, more informed debate about crime. You are the former director of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. You held that position from 1983 to 1987. And you went to that position from the academic world. You were a university professor. Was it an eye-opening experience to actually work with the Department of Corrections?
Well, actually, I had had quite extensive involvement with corrections before. I had directed for some years a program in the law school that provides legal services to inmates. And then there was a big controversy in Wisconsin because the Department of Corrections did not have formal rules governing institutional life and probation and parole. And I was asked to take a leave of absence from the university and to draft those rules. And I spent about 2.5 years working with the prison system. So I was in prisons probably every week for the 3 or 4 years before I became the director. So coming into prisons was really nothing new for me. What immediately led to my being the head of the prison system was there had been a riot at one of our major institutions, and I had been asked to investigate its causes and make recommendations about what to do. And upon finishing that report and making those recommendations, the governor asked me if I would become the head of the system. So it's not like I was in the ivory tower.
In the
ivory tower, but I wasn't a lifer either. So certainly coming from the outside may have been more of a shock to the people who were working in the system than it was to me.
Did you learn anything that changed your thinking when you investigated the causes of that prison riot?
It's more really a matter, I think, of sharpening and clarifying things that were probably more vague. One of the things that really became very clear to me, both as a result of the riot and things that occurred in the aftermath, is that by and large, people respond to the way they are treated. Treat them badly, they'll react badly. Treat them decently, they'll react decently. And sadly, I think one of the things that led up to that particular disturbance was that the people were being treated badly. And I think this is a road that I fear we're heading down nationally now because it's become very permissible to be harsh in the administration of institutions. And my prediction is that if we go down that road and be harsh because that's permissible, that becomes part of prison culture again. It seems to me inevitable there are going to be problems because people, by and large, don't react well to being treated badly.
What was the bad treatment that was behind the prison riot that you studied?
Well, immediately what gave rise to it was a situation in the segregation building where we had gross overcrowding. We had about 185 inmates in 65 cells. There had been a situation created whereby the dynamic was one of rigorous punishment, a lot of disorder, a lot of back and forth baiting between correctional staff and inmates. And the fact of the matter was that once an inmate got into segregation, they almost never got out because the dynamic of life in the segregation unit was one where you just got more disciplinary tickets, got resentenced to segregation, and basically never got out. There was no system for of rewards that would reward good behavior. And very honestly, the staff members were suffering in many of the same ways that the inmates were, because they were sort of sentenced to life in segregation too, and it was a very sad and unfortunate situation.
So what changes did you recommend?
Well, one of the major problems in that unit that I mentioned was they were mixing mentally ill inmates with people who had been disciplined. There at that time was no separate facility or facility of any kind for mentally ill offenders. So one of the major recommendations that we made, first of all, was the creation of a separate facility to try and identify and provide some help to mentally ill people, both for their sake and for the sake of the people in the general population. Secondly, we recommended that there be a program instituted in the segregation unit that would encourage good behavior, reward good behavior, to try to get people out of it. And in fact, we eventually did get it down to the point where that particular unit was single-celled. It had 65 inmates instead of something in the order of 185 in it. A broader concern that I had, and when I said before I learned some things or sharpened my thinking about things, Wisconsin has actually got a very proud and I think deserved tradition of decent correctional practices. I think, unfortunately, there was a whole dynamic that occurred where we sort of lost the rehabilitative ideal. We lost sight of the idea that we are really in the human service business, and that part of our responsibility is to try to make it possible and help people to live better lives when they're in the institution and live better lives when they get out. So I saw as one of my primary responsibilities the restoration of that sort of helping idea.
Would you say that nationally you think we're heading in a more punitive and less rehabilitative direction in the prisons now?
Without question. We are. That's clearly the message that legislatures are sending with the sentencing laws that they're passing, and it is clearly the message that is being sent by the kinds of decisions that are being made about prisons, like removing weights and removing all kinds of things to try to basically make life more miserable, to make people suffer more.
What's wrong with that? I mean, you know, these people committed terrible crimes. Punishment is a good deal of the reason why they're in prison in the first place. So why are you concerned about us heading in a more punitive direction with less emphasis on rehabilitation?
Oh, I think there are all kinds of reasons to be concerned about it. The first one is, what is it you want people who go to prison to learn? If you want them to learn to beat other people with sticks, then beat them with sticks. If you want to teach them that it's okay to deprive people of things that we take for granted as part of a decent life, then deprive them of those things. Those are the lessons that we're teaching, and I think they are going to be lessons that those same offenders are going to impose and teach others when they get out, because those are the lessons that they're learning. Secondly, I think it's going to ultimately create or contribute to the creation of disorder. Yeah, just from almost a cynical point of view, things like television sets and weights, etc., are methods for controlling institutions. The worst thing that you can have is an institution that doesn't have enough to do. I think, thirdly, that's going to be a costly sort of a thing. It may have this attractiveness of being less expensive. We remove school from the prison, for example. But I think that that is really short-run thinking.
Did you have any ideals that you tried to put into practice when you were head of the Department of Corrections in Wisconsin that actually failed and made you reevaluate your ideal?
Well, I tell you, First of all, let me say that when one runs a prison system and becomes a bit more knowledgeable than one would otherwise be with the very serious crimes that some offenders have committed, one comes to realize that we do need prisons. I don't for a moment by my remarks today want to suggest that I don't think that we need prisons, because we do. And if you've run a prison system and you've come as close as I have to some of the things that people have done to one another, one comes to the inescapable conclusion that some people need to be incapacitated for substantial periods of time because they just pose too great a risk that they'll do other terrible things to other people. Having said that, let me also say that I think the lesson I learned most strongly was, in a sense, as a leader, you have a choice. You can speak to what's best in people and try and draw that out, or you can speak to what's worst in them. Sadly, today, I think an awful lot of people who sort of pose as leaders, including leaders in criminal justice, are appealing to what's worst in people.
So you didn't have any of your ideals overturned by your practical experiences?
Well, I may have gone in with fewer ideals than you think. I guess what I, you know, these are problems that don't go away. I think if I learned, another thing I learned was one must persevere. You don't sort of do something for a couple of years and walk away and say, well, I solved that, that's over. These problems that we're talking about existed long before I came on the scene, and they'll exist long after. What you need is people who will persist in trying to deal with them.
My guest is Walter Dickey, former director of Wisconsin's Department of Corrections. He now works with the Campaign for an Effective Crime Policy. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Walter Dickey of the Campaign for an Effective Crime Policy. You've said that you think we need to refocus the crime debate. What needs to be changed?
Well, first of all, I think we need to change the way we talk about it. Earlier, we were talking about things like recidivism rates and the like. And I think that, as I suggested, we need to ask ourselves, what do we really want? And I think that what we really want is safety, more than anything. I think we want improved quality of life for our citizens, I hope for all of our citizens. Then I think we need to ask ourselves, how do we achieve that? And what role does criminal justice, and more specifically, what role does prison play in bringing about conditions of safety and of a higher quality of life? Well, what's safety? It seems to me safety involves having norms and rules that people agree to live by. It involves some accountability or consequence for breaking those rules. And it also involves reward for abiding by them. Very important, it seems to me. Those are important conditions of safety. Now, then I think we need to ask ourselves, well, if those are the sort of qualities associated with safety, where do those things come from? Where do those things come from? How do we achieve them? And it seems to me that the way we achieve them are through families, through communities, through jobs, through opportunity, through the kinds of things, frankly, that we would associate with communities and families that are crime-free. One way of looking at it is to ask oneself, what's the safest community one knows? And to then ask, why is that community safe? Is it because they've got so many police, a policeman on every street corner? Is it because they've got people they're sending to prison like it's going out of style? Are those the characteristics of that community that make it a safe place? I think pretty clearly we would say no to that. Those aren't the characteristics of the places that we associate with being safe. Then I think we put in perspective where prison ought to be.
We're in a position right now where in a lot of communities, families have already broken apart. Drugs have already broken up the community sense of well-being. The easy, obvious thing is to send people to prison. It's much more difficult to rebuild families, rebuild communities, get drugs out of communities.
Well, two things about that. First of all, we always have a tendency to do what we know how to do. We know how to build prisons, get the architect, get the builder, do all that stuff. We're very good at that. And we tend not to do the things that we're not good at, even if the things that we're good at aren't responsive to the problem. And I would suggest that what we're doing is not responsive to the problem. Secondly, I think we're doing the criminal justice system, frankly, and communities a disservice in suggesting that we don't know how to work on these problems. If you look at cities across this country, from Baltimore to Seattle, you will find very interesting, innovative approaches to trying to rebuild communities, take them back.
What are some of those innovative approaches that you've seen?
Well, Baltimore, for example, has got a program in which they literally are trying to rebuild their community neighborhood by neighborhood. I would say that an essential element of it, and here's a role for the criminal justice system, is to create a situation of at least immediate safety so that the community can start to coalesce, frankly, so that they can start to come out of their houses. Because the fact of the matter is, even in many crime-ridden places, there are a heck of a lot more law-abiding people than there are people who are committing crimes. What we have to do is create conditions in which those law-abiding people can dominate life in those communities. That begins, I think, by creating, frankly, often through the police but through other devices, conditions of safety so that they can start to do so. We need to look at things like architecture. All kinds of innovative things have been done in the way of architecture to allow communities to come back together again. There are all kinds of things in the whole area of problem solving that have been done to just take back a park, for example, to take back a building, to get rid of a building if that building is a drug building. Things, I think, with the help of police, but where communities really take responsibility to, as I suggested, take back their own space. Sadly, we've allowed the debate, the rhetoric, and the emotion not only to dominate policymaking, but to hide from us the many things that are going on that are very useful.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Walter Dickey is Special Counsel for Policy at the Campaign for an Effective Crime Policy. He's a professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School in Madison. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.